Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is Episode 3, the March 19th edition. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the last week and beyond. We hope for this podcast to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism to our email address at podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most of the citations within can be found at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. On our minds this weekend, the possibility of info shops. In the 1990s, the U.S. attempted to emulate the info shop movement of Europe. Over the next decade, dozens of places to read, discuss, and meet opened and closed. The logistics of keeping radical space open in big and small cities, the exhaustion of being unpaid providers of social services, and the internet have changed what it means to have space and meet face-to-face. Our info shops today have to answer different questions than we did before. The Base in Brooklyn, New York, has quite a few listings for direct action trainings, including first aid, several different kinds of fighting, both self-defense, gender-determined, and others. This evolution of the traditional info shop towards a specifically direct action training center is greatly encouraging and appreciated. Editorial. One of the stories I like to tell is about the first and second wave of anarchism. The first is the glorious story about a beautiful idea that involved the conscious acts of the working class striving together towards a better world. This wave died on the fields of Catalan in 1937. The second wave was an attempt to be realistic by demanding the impossible, and was seen on the streets of Paris and Chicago in 1968, in northern Italy in the following years. If one were to quantify these two stories as I am now, one could say that the first wave of anarchism envisioned a revolution that could save the human race. The second wave aspired to something akin to an insurrection, still a grand reevaluation of the way we lived, but perhaps of the scale of a city or town, and not the whole of society. This week, these two anarchisms were confronted with a new vision of anarchism. One we've seen glimpses of in both the first and second wave, but that I'd like to evaluate on its own terms. In some ways, this new kind of anarchist practice is a return to DIY or do-it-yourself politics with an anarchist gloss. In some ways, it exemplifies the kind of prefigurative politics associated with Murray Bookchin and his contemporaries. Finally, it represents a fascinating threat against internet shit-talkers and do-nothingists. I present you the Portland Anarchist Road Care Group. The concept is simple. Portland, Oregon, like many other cities, has shitty roads, and the state is, at the very least, slow to do anything about it. Direct action means do the things that directly impact your life, regardless of their legality or whether specialists dominate the terrain. Quikrete, spelled Q-I-K-R-E-T-E, is inexpensive, about $15 for a 50-pound bag, commercial-grade blacktop repair, also called asphalt cold patch. From the picture on their Facebook group, they used little more than a jackhammer with an attachment to tamp down the asphalt. They dressed in block, took some pictures of themselves, and wrote their communique. Quote, "Successful preliminary action today. We patched 5 potholes in Southeast Salmon between 37th and 39th. We will observe them over the following days and weeks to see how lasting our patches are." End quote. Beyond the social media storm about this action is a host of interesting anarchist conversations. Before getting to them, it's worth saying that this is the perfect anarchist moment. Soon there'll be interviews, exposés, personalities, and more details about Park. But for now, we only have their simplest of statements about themselves. Quote, "Because we believe in building community solutions to the issues we face outside of the state, because society portrays anarchists as only breaking windows and blocking roads, because when faced with anarchism as a political theory, statists often ask, but who will fix the roads? Because the city of Portland refuses to adequately repair roads in a timely manner, we are Portland Anarchist Road Care. We believe in community-oriented direct action. We believe the state cares more about funding a militarized police force to suppress free speech than caring for and repairing roads. Portland Anarchist Road Care aims to mobilize crews throughout our city and our neighborhoods to patch our streets, build community, and continue to find solutions to community problems outside the state, end quote. For whatever other criticism I or anyone else makes of their actions, they have made the anarchist case simply and clearly here. More importantly, they have demonstrated a nearly perfect insurrectionary action. They could never repair another pothole again, and this project could be considered a success because they demonstrated how easy it was for nearly anyone to fix their own potholes. Up till now, I've been quite reticent to consider that the second wave of anarchism, what could be called the post-revolutionary wave, or even the insurrectionary wave, may be receding. I'm still not quite there yet, but the idea of anarchists using insurrectionary methods to create a group that does community-repaired potholes seems like a first step towards something new. Clearly, I don't care two bits for the park project on its face, but anarchists that no longer think and talk big, and instead put on some boots and do something that mostly isn't for their own benefit, but is, I don't know what to think about that. Sure, this is a small and furtive effort, but, among other things, this action challenges our preconceptions about whether our project should be entirely negative. Even if they did a shitty job in repairing their local road, they made as good of an effort as Food Not Bombs does in feeding people, the Black Bloc does at being heard by the body politic, or anarchist theorists do at being heard telling people to demand freedom. What is creative about PARC isn't their answer to the age-old question about who will fix the roads, but the fact that they took the punchline and made it theirs. Filling five potholes is a more serious intervention into the question of contemporary anarchist practice than 1,000 comments on anarchist news. This week, dozens of anarchists were arrested in Belarus after anti-government protests in three major cities, Minsk, Mogilev, and Grodno. People took to the streets protesting against government attempts to collect tax off the unemployed. In Minsk, demonstrators managed to gather more than 1,500 people. In Mogilev and Grodno, 1,000 each. These are the biggest protests these cities have seen in decades. It's worth mentioning that most of the protesters are far from major political powers in the country and do not align with any opposition stream, rather prefer to point out the hard economic conditions and results of 24 years of Lukashenko's rule. Around 40 anarchists organized in a separate bloc participated in the demonstrations with banners saying, "For the people, the main social parasite are the bureaucrats, politicians, and the police." Anarchists are fixing potholes on city streets in Portland. Clearly this is mentioned several times this week as it sort of is the big talking point in North American anarchism. CrimeThink issued a deep historical essay called Slave Patrols and Civil Servants. It's a history of the police as an evolution of slave patrols, with the result being a dual history, one of violent exclusion and one of insidious inclusion. In Bloomington, Indiana, sabotage in memory of Lombros Fundus. Glue is applied to 50 parking meters, locks, coin slots, and card readers in honor of the anniversary of the death of Lombros Fundus, one of the over 500 anarchists arrested at the Polytechnic riots in 1995, who was shot dead by the police in 2010. Also in Greek news, two social centers in Athens are under attack. The Greek government attacked on the dawn of 313, listening to the commands of the conservative right and neoliberal media of mass manipulation, and they attacked two occupations of the broader social movement in Athens. Putting into practice, adding to the conversation on anarchist activity in Montreal, is a respectful dialogue with the text from Putting in Common or Messe en Commun, that has been circulating critiquing insurrectionary projects and perspectives in Montreal. Dialectical Delinquents posted their News of Opposition, January and February 2017. This is a list of actions, mostly international, mostly spectacular, and listed by date. The Hampton Institute has posted the transcript of an interview with the Facebook page Anarchist Memes called Striking While the Iron is Hot, Trump and the Antifa Resistance, where they discuss Trump's rise to the presidency and how people can more actively resist the fascist-esque politics that are currently being put in the mainstream. And finally, in March 15th in Montreal, every year March 15th has a sort of annual protest that's organized by a group, I think, called COBP, but it's basically opposition to police brutality. A couple hundred people gathered yesterday evening at the Palace Valois in Hochelaga for the 20th annual edition of the demonstration against police brutality, organized by the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality. It was the day after the largest snowstorm of the year in Montreal, and mounds of snow lined the streets, which meant obstacles for both demonstrators and the police. Eventually, during the march, they were kettled by the cops. With shouts of En Fosse, let's push, and an inspiring confidence and swiftness, before secondary cop lines could form, those kettled pushed against the riot cops, blocking the sidewalk from the east, and broke free. More riot police tried to block off the new exit routes, but there weren't enough of them, as people raced through snowbanks and snow-covered parking lots, for the most part getting away. Unfortunately, around 10 people reportedly ended up in a new kettle that formed in the parking lot outside the SPVM headquarters. They had backpacks seized and were photographed, but were let go without any tickets or charges. The demo ended with no arrests. New publications this week include the Montreal Counter-Information has produced a publication, the first issue collecting contents from the past 2 years of that project. Future issues will be released every several months to keep the material timely. For those with free access to color printers, we've included a centerfold of 24 posters. Plain Words publication came out of Bloomington, Indiana. I think that this was actually released 3 weeks ago, but I think it was prior to the start of this podcast. And finally, Sprout Distro has released a roundup of zines and pamphlets published and posted online during February of 2017. While they aren't all explicitly anarchist, they should be of general interest to much of the broad anarchist space. Finally, last week's podcasts, Anarchy Radio had a rambling conversation about the Portland Anarchist Road Care group, read a letter from James Oberhelm, who is a performance artist, and discussed white supremacy and the anarcho-primitives movement, and finally appear to have moved on to a more appropriate enemy-rival talking point, the transhumanists. This week, the Final Straw Radio featured a conversation about the Lucasville Uprising, Hunger Strikes, and Trouble, a new project by Submedia. The Anarchists issued podcast number 2, CIA Boogaloo, Vault 7, Assassination, and TERFs. They discussed WikiLeaks' publishing of the CIA Vault 7, the assassination of environmental activist Berta Cáceres by U.S.-trained assassins, and discussed trans-exclusionary radical feminists. Topic of the week, natural disasters and other trouble. This week I'm here with Dot, and we're going to talk about the topic of the week. And I'll begin by talking about what it is. This is actually not the first time that we've approached this topic. As anarchists, we may find ourselves in challenging situations. This topic of the week takes a look at the anarchist relationship with natural disasters. Hurricanes, tornadoes, blizzards, earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, etc., and other major adverse events like insurrection, war, riots, and general trouble. What can we do as anarchists when disaster, or trouble, strikes? How can we prepare and plan for these emergent situations? What does the anarchist response to such events look like? Are there any favorite tools, gadgets, technologies, or cell phone apps that one may find useful? What does anarchist infrastructure look like in terms of preparation and rollout? What are some past examples of anarchist mutual aid in times of disaster trouble? What lessons in anarchist praxis can be learned and developed from these events? Any personal stories about living through such events and general experience? So, initial thoughts, Dot?
Well, there are two disasters that I could, well, disasters being an open word, but the first one that I lived through was actually the big quake in 89. Mm-hmm. But it didn't have, I didn't have anarchists in my life particularly, and it wasn't actually that big of a disaster for people in San Francisco, which is where I was. I didn't get to go home that night. I had to spend the night at a friend's house. But obviously the places where it was really bad were further south. So
well, this was pre-cell phone. Did you just knock on their door? Did you actually
call them? No, I called them.
So the phone lines were still up?
Some of the phone lines were up. And I might have seen them because we were in school together. So that was, I was able to call people on this side of the bay and see, like, make sure they could take care of my dog and nobody was burning down or dying or anything. Mm-hmm. But not anarchists. So that's not that useful. And then the next thing that, again, I'm not entirely clear I would call it a disaster, but was 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the anarchist response at that time in the Bay Area was with me and a couple of other friends of mine, was to get as many people in a room together as possible to talk about what we were going to do or what the response was going to be. And
so you used a phone tree.
And we used a phone tree, yeah.
People that you generally knew were anarchistic.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we all got into a room and it turned into a shit show, partly because we hadn't prepared properly for the fact that people were actually going to be stressed out. And mm-hmm. We treated it more like a business meeting than a regular organizing meeting than, like, we didn't allow any time for people to sort of
vent.
Yeah, which I think, and I've looked back on it multiple times since then, and I feel like that was the biggest single error that we made. The actual conflict that came out of it was all along the lines of politics, mm-hmm. because, of course, we did have people in the room with very different kinds of anarchy, but that probably people, or there's an argument anyway, that people would have been more capable of dealing with their political differences if there had been a humanizing moment at the beginning mm-hmm. of the process, or people talking about, being freaked out and afraid and excited and fascinated or whatever the different feelings would have been. So there's that. And then the other thing that I have to say about this topic is that I have met with, there was a while where six people, I think it was six, I was one of them, were meeting to talk about burnout and talk about people leaving, not necessarily being anarchists anymore, but not hanging out with other anarchists mm-hmm. and not thinking of themselves.
Leaving
the milieu is the phrase, yeah. One of the things that we talked about was how small crises actually are breaking points for people. Not even disasters are a time.
Pregnancy or like being a call out.
Anything. Getting sick and not having enough people to help you. Let me just follow through with my point, which is that what we ended up thinking about is how churches do a good job of maintaining, of creating and then maintaining connections with people who have needs that don't necessarily have anything to do with the purpose of why people are gathering, but are part of, being alive and getting older and having problems and building connections with each other. And so disasters are huge, big areas where lots of people are having a similar problem all at the same time, and it's very easy to see this is the problem. The earthquake is the problem, the flood is the problem, but that small crises in people's lives are happening all the time. Anyway, so I'm just sort of thinking about the connection of those two things, and at the time of the us thinking about how could we take on some of the tools that the church uses, where they have pastors who, for example, who go to people's houses and check in on them, mm-hmm. whether or not they go to church, and these sort of maintaining social ties outside of large groups, so the large group meetings have one purpose, and then the small get-togethers have a different purpose, and where there's a role of a particular person who's specifically supposed to do that and is expected to do that. And we don't have that kind of thing. We have different things. We have parties and meetings, And those are the main...
Book fairs.
Sure. Book fairs and housemates. And so those are the sort of... Those are the levels that we have to work with at this moment.
I mean, the example that was cited in the common thread was Katrina.
Of course, right.
Common ground, yeah. And Katrina is such a great example of this problem for all the reasons that you mentioned. You know, the idea of outsiders going to a town that's a fairly insular town and all the weirdnesses and problematics that come out of that. The fact that the on-the-ground anarchist organizers who initiated Common Ground had very different motivations, some more selfish than others, some more state-sponsored than others. And it does make me consider that example versus the 9/11 example, which is sort of more like a phone tree, and perhaps could be described as the result of a cosmopolitan type of perspective, you know, because when you look at the spray of people who are in that room, the reason they were there were because of social ties much more than political ties. And so perhaps this question is very difficult for anarchists because anarchists have both a social and a political dimension. They tend to poo-poo their own social dimension, which means that they wouldn't necessarily do their anarchism particularly well. Mm. But perhaps, you know, if that group were more of a circle of friends, let's say the 9/11 group, it would not have been as cantankerous as
for
being
sure.
a social group plus some anarchist political types who wanted it to be anarchistic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The overloading of any particular, like, events having to carry a lot of weight from different agendas tends to break things.
Well, because I'm in the middle of reading this news podcast, of course, I'm thinking much more along the lines of the political problems rather than the social problems. But it does seem like in the circles that I know that call themselves anarchist, the social problems might be solvable because, of course, at some point you draw a line and you say, we're not really friends with those people, so let's not invite them. But it would mean that me personally, perhaps, would be invited to a lot less of these type of events.
Yeah. I continue to be the question of how much we are dealing with our emotional and our personal stuff through a political lens, and how much, like, there's just a Venn diagram there that it's actually used. Venn diagram is a wrong, because there's clear lines for a Venn diagram, and this is just so murky, and people are doing so many different things all at the same time that it's really hard to chart.
I do find a bit of a problem of talking about anarchists being uniquely qualified in moments of trauma or large-scale trauma, because I think that the takeaway most people get when they're part of a disaster, whether it's the electricity going out in New York City, earthquake in 89, or even 9/11, is how much people helped each other. And it didn't require a sort of questionnaire.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mean to say that about the front. What I meant when I was talking about not being surrounded by anarchists is just that it wasn't a valid reflection of what anarchists do to help each other.
I was talking about the topic of the week more than...
Oh, very well. Yeah. Again, this seems to me like a connection between, like a conflation between social stuff and political stuff. Because actually when a disaster happens, I think that people are in general most likely to call the people they're actually friends with. And if that's anarchists, which sometimes it is, I mean, a lot of the time it is here anyway, then that feels like it's the same thing. But it isn't, you know... Probably we're not going to call the people who we're having anarchist meetings with if that's the extent of our connection with them. But I haven't been in that kind of organizing scenario in so long that, yeah, it's hard to...
One of the questions that this topic asks is sort of about the gear, about the gear. And that is an interesting question, because I think that anarchists are allergic to sort of the way of thinking that preppers use.
Mm-hmm.
Preppers clearly are people...
Because preppers use it.
Right. Right, no, and that might be to the detriment of anarchists.
Yeah.
Of course, we've talked about in different contexts the fact that there's a body of people in New York who are sort of ex-anarchists but are still in the broader milieu, who have made some inroads into some of the prepper sort of dialogue. And it's interesting that a lot of the people who sort of are more anarchists and refer to this, what's the project called?
Woodbine.
They mostly make light of the prepper sort of aspects of it, and I wonder if that's sort of to our detriment, that you know, that basically we're not willing to make that connection, or if the gear aspects of preppers is perhaps, you know, it's the opposite of a social solution, right? And that perhaps anarchists by their nature just think that, that people will get through.
Yeah, it's tempting to think about that anarchists, especially I think the kind of anarchists who I'm most interested in or who are most fun for me to talk to and hang out with are imaginative and are creative and are not necessarily the people who are, okay, I'm making a false dichotomy here, but who are not trying to be practical. Like there's a thing about practicality that is very important on one level, but in another way around anarchists, it can demonstrate itself as, you know, what are the steps we're going to take to get to the revolution or something. And those are not generally the kind of anarchists that I want to talk to. So, yeah, sorry, I just went off on that track. But there is something about anarchists being dreamers that I find very important and special. And that dreaming and being imaginative does absolutely can be part of a DIY ethic and a part of an infrastructure ethic, but it isn't a sort of no-brainer connection. It's a, you have to figure out that connection, I think.
Thank you very much for your time, Dan. What's new this week in detail? Insurgent Methodology for the Revolutionary Left is a fascinating essay, not particularly anarchist, that comes from a blog called fighttowin.noblogs.org. It sort of seems to come off with a more Leninist perspective, but I want to read some bits of it because I think it does inform perhaps the space in which revolutionary politics talks about itself in the 21st century. What is class war? Class war is a war between social classes. It characterizes any historical formation that is split between competing socioeconomic groupings, dominant classes, and subordinate classes. In modern capitalist society, we exist with nothing less than a permanent state of class war. It's all around us, whether we recognize it or not. It permeates the ensemble of social relations we live and die within. The normalization of class violence is so deeply ingrained into the dominant social relations of this society to the point that this violence does not even appear as violence, but instead as justified force. If we are truly dedicated to building a world where every person has what they need to live a healthy life and is free to develop their full human potential, then there is no way around the question. Proletarian violence, strategically directed at ruling class institutions, is an inevitable aspect of the struggle for human self-emancipation. To be effective, class war tactics must pose a material threat to ruling class power. On a general level, this can only happen if these tactics are based on the struggle of poor and working class people, that is, proletarians. Us proletarians are the immense majority of people in the world. Because we do not own means of production of our own, in order to survive, we have to sell our labor power to capitalists in return for a wage that represents only a fraction of the total wealth we produce. The global proletarian produces more than enough resources to provide everyone in the world with the means to live a healthy life, free of class exploitation and state oppression. The proletariat has the potential to reorganize the total social wealth on a communal basis, but the means of production are not owned in common. The bourgeois minority owns the means of production, privately, and appropriates the surplus wealth of its own for its own private interests, rather than the interests of all. Thus, there is a historical conflict between the socio-economic interests of the proletarian class and those of the bourgeoisie. This conflict is both practical and theoretical. What is insurgency? Insurgency is organized class violence employed against a state power. At its core, it's an extension of the overall class struggle, and it can serve the interests of any class. An explosion of popular will might result in an insurgency like that in France of 1789, or in Saint-Domingue, which would become Haiti, in 1791. At the other extreme is the conspiratorial coup d'état, where a small group of plotters replace state leaders with little participation or support from the people at large. This is what happened during the military coup of Spain in 1936, which resulted in the fascist Franco dictatorship. Insurgencies generally fall somewhere within these two extremes. There have been many different insurgent strategies throughout history. Insurrectionist, military-focused, urban, rural, protracted, identity-focused, etc. Anti-capitalist and anti-authoritarian insurgents should use a composite strategy that includes tactics drawn from several of these strategies: insurrectionist, urban, and protracted. An insurrectionist strategy involves the organization of a militant political cadre that is capable of waging a strategic offensive during a revolutionary situation. Lenin advocated this approach when leading the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917. Insurrectionist organizations often have more auxiliary members involved in intelligence gathering and political agitation relative to the number of active insurgents, and remain secretive as long as possible. They emerge to carry out an insurrection only during a revolutionary period when the proletariat is on the offensive, state power is in crisis, and success can be decisively achieved. They go on, referring of course to Mao, to talk about a phase one, strategic defensive, when the state has a stronger correlation of forces and insurgents, must concentrate on small actions, survival, and building a political base. Phase two, strategic stalemate, when force correlations approach equilibrium and warfare becomes the most important activity. Phase 3, strategic counteroffensive, when insurgents gain superior strength and move to destroy the state's police and military forces. Another common feature of revolutionary wars is that the side that learns faster and adapts more rapidly, the better learning organization, usually wins the war. Anyways, very much not so much an anarchist essay, but interesting because of how much anarchist rhetoric clearly the new left has learned. Next, I'm going to read from Floodgates, The Urge to Obey, A Flight from Initiative and Identity Politics. This is from the new publication from Bloomington, Indiana, Plain Words. We receive and transmit. Traditional systems of authority are dead or dying. It matters increasingly less whether one identifies with their job, loves their country, kneels before God, or worries about tarnishing the family name. In the past, anarchists have fought to the death against these institutions, believing that if people rose up and destroyed them, humanity would be free. While these relics are decaying, it's due to many different forces, rebellion not being primary. As a result, daily life is still bound to alienation, livelihood to the whims of the precarious market, and obedience maintained by the threat of the justice system. Humanity is still submissive, but our rulers are faceless abstractions, invisible flows of capital, imagination-killing technologies, the justice system. These systems have their agents in our midst, police, prison guards, CEOs, judges, but they no longer solicit respect. They just do their jobs to keep the system running, and they're interchangeable in our minds. On February 22nd, in an article posted called "Is the Black Bloc a Racist Tactic in the Trump Era?", the content of the essay is uninteresting, but there's something about the contemporary world that reveals itself when reading this. The author does not want white people to wear masks during demonstrations. They do a poor job of arguing their position, but that isn't what's important. Similarly to how, in order to show expertise and authority, medical professionals list their degrees and certifications next to their name, and professors name their areas of studies and degree, the author writes next to their name, transgender, QPOC, Latinx activist, and they do so immediately before calling out white people for being racist. Whether it's a conscious decision or not, the author, by listing these after their name, commands an air of authority among the socially conscious readers of their essay, especially for white people who often, more than the destruction of white supremacy, want to avoid being called a racist. Followers without a leader have discovered identity politics, and we're seeing in the contemporary period is that they now have something to lead them. The figure, a tokenized member of insert oppression category community, is seen as a legitimate source of guidance, leadership, and ultimately authority when there are so few left. Like communism in the mid-20th century, this ideology has constructed itself in a way that is not allowed to be questioned, or one would be tarnished as a counter-revolutionary, or rightist, or in our case, charged as a racist. In the framework of ally politics, the ally is supposed to follow the leadership of oppressed community and its leaders, regardless of whether they agree with them or not. As anarchists and others have been saying for probably a decade or so now, this doesn't even make sense. Two people sharing a category of oppression does not mean they agree with each other. How racist can you be to suggest that two black people will have the same opinion on everything? Nevertheless, when someone disclaims their identity the way this author does, it's perceived as a pronouncement to obey. Like all authority, it doesn't matter if what they say makes sense, you're supposed to follow them either way. What else would sate a follower's lust for direction and guidance than authority figures that you're not allowed to disagree with? And when was the last time liberals and leftists had a system of authority that appeared to somewhat engage their morality? Finally, leaders, someone with a conscience, can feel good about. People who go through certain experiences probably have knowledge about something that people who lack such experience do not. This society is violent towards people it's classified as belonging to specific groups, race, gender, sexuality, and at their expense, it privileges other people. How these factors play out during moments of resistance is a complicated question. But surely listening to people who have experienced something that's relevant to the current struggle makes sense. This essay is not contesting these things, or arguing that oppressed people are now in positions of authority. What's being commented on is the culture of the contemporary moment, where a penchant towards respect and authority is not being satisfied by traditional routes, and has found the realm of identity politics to unleash itself. That sometimes people tap into this dynamic and use it for their own gain is to be expected. Perhaps this partially explains why identity politics is so repulsive towards conservatives. They still believe in following God, nation, the family, and all the rest. The drives towards obedience circulating through them have never been cut off. Next, I'm going to read from the latest communique from the Conspiracy of Cells of Fire, which is a Greek group. This is called Nemesis Project, Act 2, and it is the communique that results from a parcel bomb attack against the German Minister of Finance. 9 years after the first appearance of this Conspiracy of Cells of Fire in January 2008, more than 300 attacks against targets of domination that resulted in tens of millions of euros in damage and the transferring of fear to the camp of power. After more than 60 arrests of comrades and other individuals over the years who have been accused of being our members, and the thousands of years of imprisonment imposed upon them. After so many times that ministers and police chiefs have declared in the media that they have managed to dismantle us and that the CCF is finished. After the inclusion of the CCF in lists of terror organizations by the State Department in the US and Europol in the EU, we continue even louder. With the creation of the international conspiratorial network of FAI and CCF cells in dozens of countries that have carried out and continue to carry out guerrilla attacks with even greater passion and tenacity to not only attack the infrastructure of the system, but also the people in power. Always against social apathy. Always against the oppressors of our lives. Still, they cannot understand that the CCF is an idea, and that the idea cannot be imprisoned, because it's like the Hydra. For each comrade that is imprisoned, new comrades are ready to take their place and continue on the path of attack. We still have the rage. We sent a booby-trap parcel bomb to the German Minister of Finance within the context of the campaign of the second act of Project Nemesis. A communique will follow in the coming months. Comradely greetings to the FAI Direct Action Groups in Chile and Greece for their contributions to Project Nemesis. Rebellious greetings to the FAI comrades in Italy and the imprisoned members of CCF in Greece who remain unrepentant. Forward for the Black International of Anarchists of Practice. Nothing has ended. Everything continues. Long live anarchy. Conspiracy of Cells of Fire. FAI. And finally, we're going to read from this essay called A Great Whirlwind. Anonymous. The whirlwind is coming. You can feel it in your bones. Look, the workers aren't doing shit. I'm a worker. Been working since 15. And I'm literally not doing shit because I'm young and jobless. And despite all my efforts, I remain that way. The second coming, Armageddon, the end of the world, blah, blah, blah. What happens now is this shit continues to get worse until the point where bourgeois hedonism blows up in the fucking planet. We have no armies to stop them, and even if we did, armies and armor and strongmen and lugols are how we got here to begin with. The fucking trots or anarchists sure as fuck aren't going to march into town and liberate us. So what happens now? Seriously, what happens? I have less and less faith in the old Bolshevik proverb, decades can happen in weeks. by the second. When I was around 19, I went down to the beach to see the love of my life. Little did I know at the time, she was also the love of my life to three other boys. Not that I cared. I was also guilty of the same at a different time in our relationship. But when I was with her, nothing mattered. I just wanted to be near to her. Cliché, I know. It was intoxicating. Anyway, in the middle of the night, closer to dusk than midnight, she asks me, "Will you jump off a bridge for me?" "Show me the bridge," I said. So off we went. She counted to three, and neither of us jumped. She counted again, but hesitated, and I jumped anyway. She followed close after. We are not pacifists, or blankists, nor Bolsheviks. No, actually, what I think I'm talking about here, I'd have to call communization, collectivization, anarchist communism in practice in the 21st century. Because in order to prevent dead babies in freezers, which I remind you is already happening, we have to learn to unplug from this system and support ourselves again. Because I don't want to live in a brave new world of fucking Marxist grocery stores. Ending capitalism would be as difficult as destroying the pillars of the Leviathan's foundation. Capitalism, of course, relies on labor, human and non-human. The non-humans, like the adults of civilization, still try to revolt and flee from the Leviathan at every opportunity. We animals could learn something from the non-humans. Every non-human I know is on strike, at least some of the time. Introduction to Anarchism. One of the aspects we have not discussed yet about the website Anarchy 101 is that it is a question and answer site that allows a lot of conversations around both the sort of motivations behind particular questions, and then it acts like a Q&A site where users can vote answers up and down. For this particular question this week, I'm going to read three different answers to the same question. Here we go. How have you convinced another that anarchy is not chaos, and anarchists are not just window breakers? I don't want to be pretentious. I don't want to tell others how to think. Still, I would like the masses of anti-establishment people to realize that the establishment would die if enough of us decided to treat it the way we see it. And importantly, that people can self-organize without government, not just degenerate into monsters. I don't want to influence anyone. Nobody likes to be influenced. Do you just sit back and watch and hope people wise up? Have you ever helped anyone become an anarchist? If so, how? The first answer comes from Dot. I haven't been in a position to convince anyone of anything for a long time. And when I was, I proffered myself as an alternative to the stereotype. And of course, there are all kinds of examples at what even normies think of as positives. The 8-hour workday and some such shit. That anarchists have helped bring about. But also my arguments are frequently to question why chaos is such a bad rap in this culture, and to trouble the idea that peace and reliability are such awesome things, at least given the bedrock that we are dealing with. As much as it might irk me to acknowledge it, given other issues with the project that are not relevant to this question, CrimeThink does a fine job of addressing this topic, I think. Their texts tend to celebrate, in ways very friendly to newcomers, a range of behaviors that I would include for anarchists. I'm wondering about your association of pretentiousness and telling other people how to think. But maybe that's just a random juxtaposition. At any rate, some of the most carefully unpretentious people are the ones who are most controlling, in my experience anyway. Finally, this whole site is an effort to show that people can do things without the government and other large institutions. The next answer is by Ingrate. I talk to and engage honestly with people. It sounds trite when I write it, but that is really it. People have a particular image of what an anarchist might be, and while I am, at least initially, a lot like most other folks assume an anarchist in North America looks like, white, male, etc., I'm also above the assumed median age of anarchists, and I can talk about my beliefs and actions without falling it into hyperbole. That said, I don't try very hard to make people think anarchy isn't about chaos and window breaking. Engaging with your question on a deeper level, I don't try to dissuade people of the idea that anarchy might mean chaos. It likely will, and that is fine. Anarchy kept us all somewhat in line through their own use. It is likely to be a bit hectic. People will still be raped. Murders will occur. I'm too honest to believe that language will break down entirely, but it might perhaps become less static. I'm fine with all this, and entirely honest with people I talk to about the fact that I am fine with this. To the window breaking, if someone finds this website, they're probably already familiar with the trope of the anarchist as a window smasher, so I'll make the assumption that I don't need to elaborate on where this came from. Often, anarchists from the left side of the big tent worry about how to present our politics as more than angry, masked-up hooligans trashing shit. I feel absolutely no need to dispossess people of the idea that property destruction and violent confrontation are parts of anarchist practice. Attack is a relatively central part of my conception of anarchy, and while I'm less and less directly involved in these moments of direct and explosive confrontations the more I age, I have absolutely no desire to construct arguments about the beautiful idea that create a false dichotomy between the building and the destroying. If pressed, I would argue that I personally value the destroying side of the equation more heavily than the building side. Finally, an answer from Nihilist. I don't think I've ever convinced anyone that anarchists aren't window smashers. And to tell you the truth, I like the image a little better than normal, reasonable people, even though there's no reason why someone can't be both. I also don't care what people think of anarchists as a group anyways, because some deserve the bad opinions that people have of them. I have, however, on numerous occasions, tried to convince people that police, authorities, and nation-states don't actually make the world a better place. And unsurprisingly, people don't need much convincing when it comes to this point alone. When they do, there's not much of a point in arguing with them, because trying to make someone else think a different way starts to defeat the purpose of being an anarchist. I don't want to live my life feeling responsible for other people's thoughts, just the same as I don't want to be responsible for the greater good, whatever that means. Finally this week, to learn more. For an introduction to anarchism, anarchy101.org. For books and other anarchist material, littleblackcart.com. For news and up-to-the-minute commentary of anarchist news, and to see the citations that this podcast uses, go to anarchistnews.org. Email us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. Also, a thanks to Lynn O'Mabel for the sound editing work, and for Dot for participating in the topic of the week conversation. See you next week.